Hey everyone, my name is Marissa and I'm a junior political science major, mathematics minor at Howard University.
And hi, my name is Sean and I am a sophomore at the University of Arizona. I study global intercultural understanding.
Sean and I got together as a team as a part of an undergraduate think tank with the United States Russian Foundation. The purpose of this think tank was to advance diversity, equity, and inclusion in Russian, East European, and Eurasian studies. While working on the think tank, Sean and I had the chance to work with faculty members on a research project and present our findings at the National Convention held online for the Association for Slavic and East European and Eurasian Studies, also known as ASES.
And we just want to say a huge thank you to Emily and Eric, our two mentors that have helped us along our journey in this project and research endeavor. Thanks a lot. No, for real though, thank you.
With that being said, here is your brief introduction to our project, Vladimir Putin's Rise to Power, the System That Made Him.
Vladimir Putin has been ruling Russia since 1999. In that time, he shaped the country into an authoritarian and militaristic society. He successfully invaded two of Russia's neighbors and strengthened ties with Syria and Iran. He's intent on pushing back against the Western world order, and it appears to be working.
Putin, Vladimir Putin, 17 years and the most powerful man in the world.
To understand how one man could have such a powerful influence on this country, you need to go back to the chaos and corruption that gripped Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Wow, that was very intense. That was from a Vox published documentary called From Spy to President, The Rise of Vladimir Putin. But also a very great segue into our project. So take it away, Sean.
We had a couple of questions and we wanted to know, how has an ordinary former Soviet Union intelligence officer been able to ascend through the Russian political world and become the face of the Russian government? And for us, we understand, like a lot of people, like in academia and people that study Russia as a career and just every day and stuff, they oftentimes look at just Putin from like an individualistic standpoint. And our idea was to look at it from a structural standpoint, a systemic standpoint, to understand the Russian political system and how it functions. And how it allows a figure like Putin to, well, take power, keep it, and kind of, well, you could say, do as he pleases. So we presented our findings at the convention, as was mentioned, and we came to several conclusions. We decided to look at this. In order to look at Russia, we had to look at it, well, you could say like backwards. So we looked at it from the period of the Tsar up until the 90s, when kind of Putin cemented his power. And then we looked at kind of an after Putin. What are the possibilities of after Putin? Is there something set in place or things that happen like that? We have all these questions we want to resolve. And we want to talk about and discuss. That's what we're doing today. So I'm going to start us off by giving a little background on Russia. We know that the Russian state has gone through many changes, that being the absolute monarchy, the Tsar, the USSR and socialism, and the Russian Federation. Russia has a long, interesting history. It started, actually it's very long, but we're going to start from the Tsar. So you had Nicholas Tsar, and you had him, and you had the peasantry of Russia. You had the famous revolution in 1917, where the Bolsheviks rose to power and they would change fundamentally. They would fundamentally change Russia forever. This political change would not just develop from the 1990s until the mass of Stalinism in the Soviet bloc, but it would also cement this kind of interesting system that we see today in Russia. You see this division amongst the working class, the peasantry, and the oligarchy and the elites that live in metropolitan areas.
Right, exactly. And going back into that historical context,
like Sean said, in 1917, you had the rise of Vladimir Lenin, the Bolsheviks, and the Soviet Union. Most people remember the Russian Revolution as very violent, and obviously it brought about the rise of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. I don't know about you, Sean, but me personally, growing up, I never really heard nice things about communism, you know? Probably had a lot to do with, you know, where we grew up, where we are. But after doing research, it was very eye-opening to see how the Communist Party was able to come to power, because before the Soviet Union, like Sean said earlier, under Tsarist rule in Russia, they lived under a peasantry. So you either had czars or royals, and their circle, I guess you could say, the people high up in government, things like that, they lived illustrious lives, you know? They lived great lives, but the normal everyday people in Russia, they didn't have much. And so it made sense as to why they looked to communism as a way to save them, as a way, the idea of equality for everyone, even in terms of economic equality, it would have been appealing for them, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, so when we talk about the Russian Revolution, we have to also understand that it was something that fundamentally changed not just Russia in general, but also changed the world. Just a little background on the Russian Revolution. It is known as the October Revolution. In 1917, Russia went through two revolutions, one that would happen in February from the 24th to the 29th, and the one that would happen in October from the 24th to the 25th. The first revolution overthrew the Tsarist government, or the Tsarist government. And so that first revolution got rid of the Tsar, got rid of that system of government. And then it would be replaced with a provisional government of the Duma, members mostly of the Cadet Party, who allowed a contact commission of the Petrograd Soviet to advise the government. But this did not stop, because they overthrew one system, the revolution was not done. That government was hit with protests and strikes against the new government. They quickly grew as Russia's involvement in World War I lingered on. So the provisional government responded by establishing a coalition government with the executive committee of the Petrograd Soviet. This would form a confused bureaucratic regime. It would make the government inactive, because they would clash on important things. This would make them inactive on things like the white bread famine that was happening, slaughter that was happening. That was going on. So when it hit October the 24th to the 25th, the Bolshevik Party, it was led by the Russian workers and the peasants. Revolution of the Soviet, all power to the Soviets, basically. And on that, during that same time span, about a day later, the second all Russian Congress of Soviets met and created the Soviet government. And so they had new elections, they had a new Council of People's Commissioners, and the Central Executive Committee. And so they would work on the first socialist society in human history. But they encountered extreme obstacles. So they were attempting peace with all nations and things like that. Only Germany agreed to peace. Only Germany. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. You didn't know that, did you? So when when World War I ended, fresh off the battlefields of the Western Front, you know, those magical powers of the US, UK, France, Japan, they invaded Russia. This is also very interesting because Russia was invaded by a lot of countries, not just the great powers, but they invaded from all directions. And they were assisted by Tsar generals and provisional government politicians. A four-year civil war ravaged the country as well. So while they were being hit from the outside, they were also hit with a civil war. And then this would they would adopt what would be known as war communism in order to survive. And that is a different thing. And so we went through that briefly, and that is the background of what happened then. So you have to go from that to in order to understand that one transition. There's another transition that happens, and that deals with the rise of Stalin. So if you understand that, that one example that I'm using is that Russia's always kind of been a country of turbulence. It's never been kind of, it's never been stable from one period to another. It's always been someone trying to consolidate power, one group or another trying to consolidate power, whether it's a constant war between the working class and the bourgeoisie or the working class and the dominating power at the time or a change in systems. There's always been this confrontation. And you had this in the USSR as well. You had this when you saw the confrontation when Trotsky was exiled and there was the Stalinist regime was executing and going with his purges to get rid of its opposition. You had this when you had the restructuring of the USSR and you had this, the bureaucracy take hold and influence not just Russia, but its other allies and other, I guess you could say, kind of legs of the Communist Party in other countries, such as Spain when it had the Spanish Revolution, Germany, Italy, and so forth. And so you go from this one period and you go from this deteriorating worker state to this reintroduction of capitalism in the USSR, followed by the, I guess you could say, the downfall of Stalin. And we hit our next point in the conversation, which I'm going to, like, so what do you think about this, Marissa? So like, so we go from one point to another and you hit this reintroduction of capitalism and then you hit this transformation of society that kind of introduced a different way of doing things and kind of crumbled the USSR as we know it. So in that sense, like, what do you think happened at that time? Well, like, what can you like tell us about that?
To me, I find it very, the political scientist in me finds it very interesting how, one, people didn't see this coming, and two, I would say the world's reaction to it. When discussing this, it's easy to like remove the, it's easy to disconnect humans from history, but I always find it interesting, like, how did the Russian people feel during this time? You know, they were fed up. And so, and honestly, when people are fed up, they're willing to listen to whatever or whoever is telling them that they'll, you know, provide them with what they need. And so, transitioning from communism to, in a way, a free society, I feel like many everyday Russian citizens would have felt kind of cheated because they were promised something and they didn't get it. And then they were thrown into this whole new world, having to adjust to Westernization, but their government wasn't helping them. And so it's really eye-opening to see how all fast this all happened and how unorganized in reality it was, because everyone had so many different opinions and feelings, and it led us up there. But I also, transitioning into the Vladimir Putin conversation,
it's crucial that we understand the impact that the Russian Revolution had on the Russian government and the Russian people, and how it did allow someone like Vladimir Putin to rise to power. Right, Sean?
When we look at the systemic approach of Vladimir Putin and how the Russian system allowed him to rise and maintain power, we understand the previous iterations and evolutionary framework of the Russian system, but we must specifically look at the downfall of the former Soviet Union when talking about Vladimir Putin, because the former downfall of the Soviet Union was one that was turbulent, one that was unstable, and one that was, as Vladimir Putin had put it, a big, disastrous event in the history of, well, of Russia.
After the USSR's collapse, democratic forces led by Boris Yeltsin took over the Russian government. One of the agendas of the Boris administration was to westernize Russia. Boris Yeltsin was often looked at by many traditional Russians as a sellout because he was very friendly with Americans, the American presidents that he worked with. He worked well with the West a lot. And all in the Soviet Union, everything was owned by the state. Everything was state controlled. But one thing that Boris Yeltsin did was he privatized all these industries, the natural gas industries, oil industry. He privatized everything. And essentially how he did that was he was able to sell these companies to Russian billionaires already. And this created what is known as the Russian oligarchy today. And during this same time, Vladimir Putin was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, his hometown. So as all this is going on, Vladimir Putin is creating a name for himself in St. Petersburg, which is a particular bigger city in Russia. So he's making a name for himself. As a former KGB officer, he already had friends in the politics. So he really took advantage of his position in the Russian government as the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. He made friends, doing favors, political favors for all types of people. And that's essentially how he was able to rise up and become prime minister of Russia. So after Vladimir Putin left St. Petersburg, he became a member of Boris Yeltsin's administration as director of the Federal Security Service and secretary of the Security Council. And finally, he became prime minister in the fall of 1999. After Yeltsin resigned, however, Putin became acting president. As president, Vladimir Putin secured his power in Russian courts. He secured this power by bringing his political associates from St. Petersburg that I had mentioned before, and he appointed them as provincial officials. After these appointments, Putin exiled independent television and oil companies, making their assets nationalized. Now, this is important to note because this is a big difference, huge major difference between Vladimir Putin's ideologies and Boris Yeltsin's. But in doing this, Vladimir Putin was able to eliminate all political threatening patronage systems in Russia. And these two steps allowed the Putin administration to have power in Russia politically and financially.
So with that said, we also would have to look at the inner workings, I guess, of Russia, a little bit like in that transition and currently now. There were key instances where Vladimir Putin would go on to assert himself once he maintained power. aside from, as Mercedes mentioned, when he was deputy mayor in St. Petersburg, he also, from that point, also used that power to influence the private sector and talk to his contacts and gain more, a step up. And this allowed him to, well, kind of move up and just like hold power. This is interesting because the system that Russia works with is very, somewhat you could say, complex. Somewhat you could say as well, overall different. Something that you don't really see in many places. I mean, you could say similarly that China has something similar going on, but it's completely different, and we don't want to really make too many comparisons there.
Exactly. Very different approaches.
Yeah, exactly. But when we look at what Putin has to do in order to maintain this power, as he built up those contacts in St. Petersburg, he then would consolidate more power by crunching is maybe a strange word, but I guess you could say consolidating and getting rid of things he considered unnecessary, like getting rid of governor's elections, making districts or counties bigger instead of having multiple ones, just consolidating them into just several people and things like that. Now, we also have to look at the populace of Russia and what he does specifically to kind of convince people that he is the one that should maintain power and that he wants to gain support. Putin works tirelessly to maintain the support. He does this in several ways. And this is how we're mainly looking at what he does. So we want to look at the rural areas versus the metropolitan areas and the opposition in those areas and the tools and technology that he has, well, used. So when we look at that, we also must define what we as, Marissa and myself, what we have defined kind of as metropolitan areas. So in a Western sense, you would define a metropolitan area as, well, a big area, big cities that have lots of technology and things like that. Populace is not very much considered all the time. It's just a wide area. But when we look at Russia, we're going to do it in a little different. We want to look at it in terms of not just the technology that is there, but the amount of people that live in the area and what they have access to. So you still have this deepening inequality in metropolitan areas that you also can see in the rural areas, but in a different form. But you also see access to different things in the metropolitan areas. Some people have access to internet and other resources. They can get their news from other sources, and this can create sort of a difference of opinion within Russia. But you also have the same thing happening in the rural area through different forms. You have people that mainly have to deal with state news and state newspaper. That's their only real source of information. But at the same time, Putin is tirelessly making sure to once a year have his yearly program to where he will call around. And if you're lucky, he will, well, repair something or fix something that has been broken for a long time. This does not mean that this makes people loyal because he does that. This also means that there are contradictions. Those contradictions being that although he does this yearly thing and he gains lots of support from doing it and he's constantly traveling, people also realize that he does this once a year. So you have things that could be broken or not fixed or in disarray for maybe years, months, without anything going on until Putin comes around and says, hey, fix it, get it done. And so you still have like a difference of opinion in opposition when we look at these different aspects of how these things came to be. We even can look at the oligarchs as not just a means of support for Putin, but also a means of opposition. And what those are just some of the inner workings of the system that Putin has to work around to maintain this. From that, we also have to look at the other inner workings that happen. So it's not just the fact that Putin has to use these things. It's also how he works with the state enterprises. State enterprises, although they are private and public, he also made them public. he kind of reversed some of the things. He made them kind of half and half. He's focused on rebuilding the Russian military to gain defense support. He's focused on foreign policy when looking at Eurasia, looking at Eastern Europe, and his orientation towards the Ukraine, and his orientation towards Chechnya, and things like that. He's giving the appearance of a strong man, of unifying Russia, a broken country in many eyes of the Russian people. So that system that he has to contend with is not a simplistic one, and it's fairly complex, to say the least. It involves lots of things that are different. So what do you think, Marissa? Do you think like that the way he does things, do you think it's correct? Or what do you think might happen? Like, is there a step like after Putin? Or why are these things important in that sense? What do you think comes to mind when you think about this?
Absolutely. I think it's very interesting. You said, like you made a point, like, is what Putin doing, is it right? Is it wrong? I can't really answer that, but what I can say is whatever he's doing it very well. Because compared to the Yeltsin administration, the Putin administration does have a very high approval rate from Russians. And I think one thing that is often overlooked in studies of Vladimir Putin and the Russian system is Russian people, you know? Like, how do they feel? What are their feelings towards their governments? Do they trust it? Do they not trust it? But one thing I can say is I feel that, or one thing I've read and found in my research is many Russians, they don't necessarily approve of Vladimir Putin or his tactics, but they appreciate what he does for their country. Because if we're being honest, Vladimir Putin, I'm sure with the help of many people, but he has put Russia back on the map, and he has done great things for their economy and for the lives of Russian people. But yeah, Sean, what do you think will happen? What will happen after Vladimir Putin?
That's a good question. I think that, if we're going to be frank, I think that if we recently look at what has recently happened in Russia, like current, that would be something, I guess, quite different. We can see that how most recently the thing that Vladimir Putin has done is he made it, it's just funny, because he's the only, basically, he's the only head of state. He's the one in charge right now. And so he kind of gave himself immunity when he leaves office, that he can't be charged for any crimes that he's committed. This could be seen as a failsafe to when he leaves. It could also be seen as maybe he's overthrown one day. Maybe there's an uprising and he's overthrown. It is very, very hard to tell if he's planning for a step down, because he is pretty old. I think he's about 70. He's planning just to continue to stay in power until he dies. But we also must look at the building dissidents against him, the building opposition, not just the oligarchs as well, that kind of play sort of a key role, because you do have this within the Russian system. You have what I would term as a faction fight, because you have this difference of opinion of right and left wing that's happening within Russia that is trying to push Russia in one way or another. You have the continuing rise of the feminist movement in Russia, which is trying to seek for equality. You have the LGBTQ community, which is also trying to seek equality and rights within Russia. You have the fight against the clergy and the church to make Russia a little bit more less reliant on the Russian Orthodox Church. And you also have the oligarchs who are trying to push Russia in a different direction and kind of align it more with, I guess you could say, the United States in that sense, to change how the system is, to privatize more things and benefit from those things and kind of expand to foreign investment and capital. So you have all these interesting things that are developing within Russia that could tip it one way or another, depending on the forces of either side. But you also have the peasantry, which are there, that are the poor populace in the rural and metropolitan areas, who are also looking for a difference or an alternative, absolutely, even if it's not highlighted a lot within the news that we get in the Western world or the global South and things like that. Things that we're only kind of privy to, things that we can guess about or kind of make an assumption, if you will. So in that sense, I would say that I think Putin is somewhat on the ropes. He is trying to maintain power by doing, I guess, the same thing. But it seems to be working and not working at the same time due to the rising of rise in protest in Russia, mm-hmm, the rise of just different groups wanting more.
Yeah. And going, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but going off that, I think it's really important, like you mentioned, those oppositions and these different political groups that are demanding their justice and demanding that their voices are heard, because like we said, if something were to happen to Vladimir Putin, or if he decided to step down tomorrow, who would take control? Would people take control themselves? Is there a system? Is it written in law what will happen next? Or will there be a power vacuum? And will there be a fight for power? So I think that is definitely something that needs to be noted, because we don't know what will happen next. And as it's a sign of the times, but people are demanding that their voices are heard and that they are treated equally. And as we can, Russia should know from the Russian Revolution that poor people may not have the resources, but they will have the manpower. So,
yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they if they are organized to a capacity, they could change things, just like they did in the Russian Revolution. And that could set another precedence in world history and in Russian history, mm-hmm, which would be interesting to see if it happens that way. Or because at the same time, you do have this continuing increase in inequality within Russian society. So you have the extremely rich, and you have the extremely poor, and then you have the middle. Mm-hmm. But you can see that gap widening further and further. So you can see this discontent within the population. You can see how Putin is using the system to suppress and oppress anyone that seeks to speak out against his rule, or anyone that does not want to be in his favor, and things like that. So I think all these things are interesting to consider. And with that, I don't really have anything else to add. Would you like to add anything? I mean, we've talked about the propaganda that's used in rural areas and the metropolitan areas, such as internet versus state news and state enterprises. And we looked at some other things as well. They were quite interesting. So we tried to answer our questions when we were kind of discussing this. And we found that there, even though we had over about a month or so to get a lot of research done, that this topic is pretty complex. It's not something that's easy to, I guess, discuss. You would need like lots of time. So I guess this is why, from our standpoint, we wanted to put together this introduction to this topic. And from myself, I hope you all enjoyed it. And I hope everyone like had fun listening. And thanks for tuning in, and if you want to say any closing remarks, go ahead.
No, yeah, thanks for listening. Like Sean said, this is the point in this was to spark conversation for people who didn't know, for people who are looking to know. This was definitely just a brief introduction to something that is essentially, people study these things for years, so we didn't really expect to find answers today. I don't know if we'll ever find answers, but just some food for thought. So thank you all for listening. We hope to do this again one day, right, John?
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. It'll be fun.